I would now like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Steve C. from Chula Vista.
Hey, everybody. My name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Al says I'm not supposed to be wearing a tie because I'm way overdressed for the meeting. But I had to show up with one because my sponsor demands that I do that. And I've been here, so it's coming off. So. And it stops right there. Although in my drinking days, the rest of it used to come off. And that was not a pretty show, I can tell you that. And my wife said it was no big thing, but that's something else. And I'm sorry. For shame on me. I want to thank Terry for asking me to do this. The main speaker couldn't make it. I guess they went to Tony Gwynn night or something down there. And so I've heard my story. It's not worth the seventh tradition. And I'll give you time if you want to leave now. It is okay. Where's Marcelle? Where is she? Awesome. You said it all. I want to welcome the newcomers and visitors and, gosh, all the way from the Philippines. Wow. I drank all the way through the Philippines. I drank in Subic and Cubi and Mindanao. I mean, I drank all through the Philippines. It was just, I threw up in the Philippines. I passed liquid gas in the Philippines. I got naked in the Philippines. It was not pretty, and I apologize to the Philippines, if there's anybody here from the Philippines. I have a lot of countries to apologize to. I've thrown up in Hong Kong and Singapore and Taiwan and Vietnam and Australia and New Zealand, and It's just I have a lot of apologies to do to those countries because I made messes of them, and I don't have to do that anymore. It was 10:30 a.m., February 19th, 1985, and I was sitting in a training, and they were teaching people how to do guided imagery. And I came out of that guided imagery training, and I had heard a voice, and I had written it down. And I'd written down, 10:30, February 19, 1985, you are an alcoholic, and that's okay, and I love you. And I just kind of sat there and blinked my eyes and looked around just in case anybody had heard that. And I didn't want anybody to know that. And I had been working in the field of alcoholism for about a year and a half at that point in time and was going to some trainings to become an expert in identifying alcoholics. Now, see, I know a secret that most of you, I hate to tell you this, but some of you look like alcoholics and you know who you are. And I don't. And that was always a problem because I didn't look like you and sound like you and act like you. So February 19, 1985, I didn't tell anybody at that conference. My sponsor to be was there, but I didn't tell him. And came back to San Diego, told my wife that I think I might have a drinking problem. And she goes, yeah. And I might be an alcoholic. And she said, what do you do now? And I said, well, I got to go to some AA meetings. So I was still living in Chula Vista. And so I had been going to the South Bay Alano Club as an Al-Anon and an ACA for about a year and a half. And if you think I'm going back there and admit to them that I might be an alcoholic, you'll figure my ego out later. And in fact, before I get started, I'm really sad because I was hoping for about maybe 25 or 30 more people because I have one of the damnedest talks on humility you've ever seen, but there's just not enough people here tonight to give it. And otherwise, you could have it, but you're not getting it tonight. And so I decide to go to AA, and I slide out to the Lemon Grove Alano Club. Yeah. And I go a coat and tie on a Friday night 22 years ago when Chapter 5 was really big out there. Some of you remember Bell. Bell was in full swing out there. And everybody's in biking leathers and bandanas and buck knives. And You know, they're talking about rape and pillage and stabbing and shooting, and that's in sobriety. You know? And I go there for about 6 weeks, and I go to the San Diego Spring Roundup that Easter weekend of 85. I'm driving down there going, thank you, God, I am not an alcoholic. I mean, I have seen some alcoholics, and I've heard them, and I've seen the wounds on their body, you know, and I am not an alcoholic. And so I go down to San Diego Spring Roundup and put on my Al-Anon badge. And my sponsor-to-be, Jerry Bunn, was standing there, and a guy named Paul Sullivan, they don't mind using their last names. And if you've been there on a Friday afternoon, Saturday, when they're registering, what, 200-300 people standing around? Well, Jerry doesn't whisper it. Now, he's known me for a year and a half. He's known I'm an alcoholic. I just haven't known it. And so he shouts. He just screams out. He says, Steve, when the hell are you going to get honest, admit you're an alcoholic? And I gave him the finger, and I said, it'd be a cold day in hell before I admit I'm an alcoholic to please your rusty ass. And stomped off to an Al-Anon meeting. And I went to the Al-Anon luncheon, and there was a gal, some of you have been around long enough, Ramona, an Al-Anon speaker from Oklahoma. She died a number of years ago, but she was a big Al-Anon circuit speaker. And the only thing I remember her saying that day was, you can lie to God, your husband, your wife, your children, your boss, your family, but you cannot lie to yourself. And I was just going to throw up, you know. And so I snuck out from the table, and I went out to the registration desk, and my heart's just pounding. You know, I leaned over the registration desk, and I said, can I have an A badge, please? And the lady said, excuse me? I said, can I have an A badge, please? She said, sir, I don't understand you. I said, can I have an AA badge, please? And she said, weren't you an Al-Anon? And I said, yeah. I said, but I want an AA badge. And she says, well, are you more comfortable as an AA? And to this day, I remember very clearly, the only thing I came up with is, I don't know, haven't been one yet. You know? And she said, so then I put on the A badge, and she goes, well, what we have here is a double winner. And I thought, oh, my God, give me a break, please. So my sponsor-to-be comes out of the dinner, they're out of the luncheon, and his wife, Nan, she trips doing a double take, looking at the name tag. Jerry catches her going down. She said, look at what he's wearing. So Jerry comes over and thumps me on the chest, and he said, how long have you known you're an alcoholic? I said, about 6 weeks. And he said, why didn't you tell me? And I said, well, it's no big thing. And he goes, what do you mean it's no big thing? He said, why didn't you tell me? And I said, I don't know. He said, I know why. Because you didn't want me to be your AA sponsor. And he was right. I didn't want him to be my AA sponsor. And he says, I'm it. And I said, you can't be because I already have one. Well, I didn't. I'm just standing there lying like crazy, but because I didn't want him. And I said, I have one. He said, you can't have one. I said, why can't I have one? And he says, because there's something in San Diego that you know very little about. And in San Diego, there's an organization called the Muscatel Mafia. And the Muscatel Mafia is a group of old-timers who just hang around waiting for newcomers. And when they spot one, they adopt him ahead of time. So when he figures or she figures out that they're an alcoholic, they're already sponsoring you. And so I put the word out a year and a half ago when I met you that I'm sponsoring you. Nobody else can sponsor you. Well, I'm a pretty intelligent guy. And I stood there and went, okay. I mean, hook, line, and sinker. I took the damn thing, you know. And he goes, so, we were standing, there's a couple people may remember, we were in the Sheraton at that time over at Harbor Island, Sheraton Harbor Island. And back where the main conference room were in that narrow S-turn where they had the coffee. So everybody just packed into that coffee place. And there's people today that remember this, you know, and I'm standing there and he says, I want you to call me every day for 90 days. He said, pissed you off, didn't it? No, it didn't. He said, yes, it did. And I said, no, it didn't. He said, yes, it did. I said, Jerry, it didn't piss me off. He said, yes, it did. And he said, in fact, we haven't even established our relationship and you're lying to me. And I popped him in the chest and I screamed. I said, do you know who in the hell you're talking to? Excuse me, who in the hell do you think you are? I am active duty Navy captain, 310 combat missions, 850 carrier line. Excuse me, who in the hell do you think you are? You are a retired Navy commander. I am an active duty Navy captain. Who in the hell do you think you are to tell me to call you every day for 90 days? And I'm just screaming. And I run out of breath, and he's just standing there, and he goes, are you done sharing now? And I went, yes. And he goes, so are you going to call me? I said, yes. And he said, you want to know why? And I said, yes. And he says, for that display of arrogance and ignorance, which is going to take you out drinking someday, and it damn near did about 10 years later. And so we started on this happy road of destiny, and... So how did I get there? Well, I grew up in a very dysfunctional family. And, you know, and I mean, it was full of alcoholism. There was incest towards me and my sister both. My mother and father were divorced when I was 5. My brother said he slept with a baseball. He's 6 years older, slept with a baseball bat under the bed to protect the twins. I have a twin sister. And so it was just a gnarly, gnarly family. And he split when I was 5 years old. Both of them, as I said, were alcoholics. We ended up living in Kansas. My mother died when I was 19 of alcoholism and cancer. Now, she worked in hindsight. She did a marvelous job raising 3 kids. Kept a roof on our house, food on the table, clothes on our back. Worked 7 or 6 days a week, 10 hours a day selling shoes in Kansas City. She'd come home at 6 o'clock at night. And we'd have a 2-hour window because out came the bourbon and the water. And she'd start drinking. And in 2 hours, she was toasted, and anything after that was fair game. And so there was that 2-hour window in there. And so my brother had split as soon as he could get out of the house, had long gone. Ended up going to college in Kansas. And when I joined this fraternity, today I know that the only reason I got into this fraternity because I was what was called a legacy. That meant my father and my uncle were members of that fraternity. And how do I know that? Because once I became an active, I saw what we did, the guys we did in Rush. We took them to the basement and played cards with them. Well, all 6 fraternities that I went to, except this one, I went to the basement and played cards. Because this may surprise you, because I was a geek. I'm not the stud you see here today. You know, I mean, I was a geek. I went to college with braces on my teeth at a time that nobody wore braces, for God's sake. You know, and I'm just this nerd. I don't know how to play sports. I don't know how to talk. I had 2 dates in high school. My sister still has a picture of it. It's the honest to God truth. The second date I got, I'm with this gal. We're at my uncle's house. We're having a party in the garage. You know, we're really having a whoopee time. And we try a first little kiss, and we're both wearing braces, and we got hooked. And my uncle has to come out with wire cutters and cut us loose. You talk about spreading the campus, you know. Oh, my God. So I arrive in college, and I call my cousin and say, let's go drinking. Or he calls me and says, let's go drinking. I said, why? He says, we're in college. We're supposed to. So my first day in college, I ruined 18 years of sobriety. And I start drinking. And that night, we were drinking champagne, the champagne of beer. About as light and as unbeer tasting as you can get, and I just hated it. But we're sitting there, and I'm drinking, and all of a sudden I realize I'm talking to people, and I'm having fun, and he goes away, and I put beer back in the pitcher, and I put it over on somebody else's table. But eventually I get enough down me that night that I black out, pass out, throw up, crap in my pants, the whole 9 yards. It was a pattern developing that night. I called him the next day and said, let's go do that. I have a friend today that I've had for 35 years who's seen me drunk and sober. Years ago, I asked Rich, and I said, Rich, did you ever drink in your life? Because I never saw him drink. And he said, one time, my senior prom in college. And he said, I drank so much that I couldn't remember what happened. I said, that's called blackout. And he said, I puked and I threw up, and it's just a horrible experience. He said, I got up the next day and I said to myself, why would anybody ever do that? Now, there's a concept, folks, that we don't understand. Why would anybody ever do that? And I said to him, well, you just have to push through that. See, you all understand that. You just push through that, and you get to the other side of that. And then it's fun. You know, we're going to have some fun now. And so I had some fun all through college. I thought I was running out of money, which I was, so I stole six ID cards, started writing hot checks in college at a time that they didn't have photo ID cards. So I wrote a lot of checks. I forgot that my picture was in the student annual. And so the guy who I bounced three checks off of went to the small town of college town. He takes this annual and he said, just go through this and you see him, and everybody circled the same guy. So I'm working at this grocery store and he comes and he said, some guy, the manager says, so-and-so from this clothing store wants to see you. And I knew what that was about. So I went to see him and he said, why'd you write those checks? Oh, boo-hoo, I didn't write any checks. He said, yes, sir, see all these circles? Eight merchants have identified you. And he said, you know what? We're going up and see the dean of students. And we went up and saw the dean of students and said, we're going to kick you out. And the dean of students said, it'll kill his grandfather. My grandfather was a big fish in a small town, in that small college town. And he said, I can't do it to his grandfather. So they put me on social probation for 4 years. Nobody was watching, but they put me on probation for 4 years. And then I continued to drink. Within 6 months, a guy was teaching me in this fraternity how to chug beer. I know it sounds weird. We're standing in the shower naked. We got our mouth over the nozzles, and he's turning on the cold water. And he's an open-throat chugger. And you go, boom, and his belly just pops right out there, you know. And he says, that's how you just do that, you know. So I did that, and I'm choking and drowning. But the best I could ever do chugging beer was get down to two swallows, three at the most. However, in 27 years of chugging beer, I was only beat one time. Within weeks after learning how to do that, I was a legend in that college town. I could go into any small bar in that town. They said, see that kid coming through the door? Give him a half glass start, $20. He'll beat you every time. Man, I was a somebody. I had damn well arrived. You know, absolutely had arrived. Don't drink in high school. I'm unknown. Drink in college. I'm a legend. Don't drink in high school. Don't dance. Drink in college. Date and dance every weekend. Don't drink in college. Don't know how to talk. Drink in college. Know how to talk. Oh, my God. Booze is wonderful. And I'm here to tell you, folks, I absolutely believe that. It saved me. It turned me around. It was my savior. I learned how to socialize. I learned how to be a part of. I've done this a couple times. But when I drank, the promises came true within 6 months. If I was painstaking about this phase of my drinking, I was amazed before I was halfway through with the bottle. When I drank, I seemed to know a freedom and a new happiness. When I drank, I did not regret the past. When I drank, I comprehended serenity. And when I drank, I seemed to know peace. When I drank, no matter how far down the scale I'd gone, I could see how my experience could benefit you. When I drank, my self-seeking seemed to slip away. When I drank, my whole attitude on outlook on life changed. When I drank, my fear of people left me, you betcha. When I drank, I intuitively knew how to handle situations that I couldn't when I was sober. When I drank, I suddenly realized that booze was doing for me what I could not do for myself. You damn straight the promises came true, folks. Every stinking one of them. And if they were still working, I'd be there. But isn't that fascinating? They are working. But today they're real. Then they were false. They were all false. But I didn't know that because I'm high and I'm loaded and I'm just having a ball and it's marvelous stuff and people are talking about me and they're bragging about me and they take me to other college campuses so we can go chug other people. And here he comes, you know, and I'm this legend. And I know what alcoholics look like. They look like my mother, my father. They look like my brother. They look like some of you. And you know who you are. They look like Skid Row bums. But they don't look like me. And besides that, I get out of trouble. Hot checks, I'm out of trouble. No big deal. I get drunk one night, and I end up joining the Navy. And I became a Navy pilot. I'd only flown twice in my entire life, commercial. Was not particularly in love with that. And I joined the Navy because I was too afraid to interview for jobs, which I didn't do. In fact, I was just going to stay in college because I didn't want to interview for jobs. I hated the major I had, which was business. Just hated that. And this friend talked me into flying airplanes. And so I went to Pensacola, Florida, to fly Navy aircraft, got in my very first front seat as a pilot, came back 45 minutes later, capital letters, bold print, underlined, italicized, scared, jealous. I mean, hated it. I said, oh my God, Steve, you've done some stupid things. This is the top of the stupid list. I mean, this is, here's your sign, you know, and all you have to do is go back in and tell this lieutenant, this young guy, that you don't want to fly. I mean, they want you reasonably excited about chasing an aircraft carrier around the ocean, and I'm not reasonably excited. I'm scared jealous. I don't want to do this. And I couldn't get out. I literally could not get out of the airplane. My legs were shaking so bad. And I had to drop this pencil down on the flight deck and pretend like I was looking for it till I settled down a little bit. But I have a character defect today, which has gotten me into trouble in sobriety. And I still have it. And it's called, at all costs, look good. And if you can't look good, at least don't look bad. And it's the second part of that can really get me in trouble. Because once you go by looking good, you're just trying to survive now looking bad. And I couldn't go back that journey because I'd stood up at the senior dinner and everybody said what they were going to do for a living. Well, I got a scholarship to get a master's degree. I'm going into my PhD. I'm going to work this. And what are you going to do? And I'm still that geeky guy. You know, not the stud tonight. You know, that geeky guy. And they said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to be a Navy carrier pilot. And 80 guys started laughing. I mean, laughing. And I held up the piece of paper and I said, right there is my signature. In about a year and a half, boys, I'll do something that maybe 1 in 5 million people, according to the Navy, ever does, land aboard an aircraft carrier. Thank you very much. Well, I can't go back there and tell them I can't do that. Once I'm committed, I am committed. She understands. There is no turning back. Once you step out like that, you'll die first. You'll die looking good, but you'll not admit you can't do it. And so I start flying airplanes. And for 18 years, I flew airplanes, and I hated it. Now, the image is fantastic. Who's ever seen the movie Top Gun? I was Tom Cruise before he was even born. I knew how to get that uniform on and the whites and the chokers and the sword and the whole nine yards. And I hate it. But boy, what an image. You know, walking out to the airplane, literally, with tears in my eyes, particularly at night flying or instrument flying, just terrified. I got through flight training fairly sober, and then once I got my wings, all bets were off. It ended up to where I was flying hungover. Ooh. I was flying drunk. Now, I never drank in the airplane, thank you. But when you quit drinking at 4 or 5 in the morning and you brief at 6 or 7, you're not hungover, you're drunk. During some of those episodes, because I'm going to get into a lot of recovery, I'm just going to capitalize some stuff. I, full dress uniform, threw up on an admiral in full dress uniform. I had taken off my clothes at this party. His wife found that objectionable for some reason. I don't know why. And he was chewing me out, and he kept saying, I said, sir, I have to go now, because I had to go throw up. And he says, I'm not done. He said, sir, I have to go now. He said, I'm not done, Lieutenant. Okay, you know, and just projectile puked the next morning my commanding officer calls me to his stateroom on the ship and he goes, your Navy career is over. He said, the Admiral's writing a letter of reprimand. There's nothing I can do about that. He said, I can't believe you threw up on the Admiral. I can't either. I hadn't planned that, you know, so he said, I said, sir, but I do remember something. If I remember correctly, I really was sick with the flu. I said, you wanted me to chug beer, and I said, I couldn't do that. And he said, well, we'd lost about $1,000 in this chugging contest with a couple, three ships. And he said, our reputation was online. So he literally said, this is an order. You will drink. And I said, sir, if you hadn't ordered me to drink, I wouldn't have got drunk. And if I hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have thrown up on the Admiral. And he looked at me, he goes, and he starts laughing. He said, you know, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And he gets me out of it. So I steal ID cards. I'm not a drunk. I throw up on an Admiral. I get out of that. It's not a problem. About 4 years later into that affair, we're over at El Centro, Navy El Centro. We spent the night down in Mexicali. We get in about 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, just, oh my God. And then they'd move the flight schedule around. We didn't think we were flying till that night. And so we're flying that day. Well, a social drinker would go, I can't do this. But I have a reputation because theoretically I'm supposed to be one of the better pilots they got. So I've got the student in the front seat who lives here in San Diego. We come in for a landing. I'm just really hungover. And I look at this red light flashing up on the panel, and I'm going, red light flashing on panel. I got to report that to maintenance. And it says wheels. And but I know the wheels are down because we'd gone through the checklist. And then I see the light in the red handle. The gear handle is on. I go, light in red handle. And then I'm just sitting there, and all of a sudden I went, well, I won't say what I said. But all of a sudden I looked up and I said, oh my, no wonder we're in trouble. The gear is up. And you know the gear is up because it makes a very loud noise when it hits the runway. It doesn't go squeak, squeak, you know, it goes crunch, you know. And we smacked the runway and we leapt into the air. And I was flying an airplane that had jet engines, but it had props on the front of it, turboprops. And so we leapt into the air, and the tower said, you have a problem? And I said, I'm not sure yet. And so we climbed overhead to slow flight the airplane, and it checked out just as advertised. Couldn't figure out what the hell had happened. So we fly back to North Island, didn't scramble the emergency crew. We land. Fritz says, well, what do we do now? I said, well, you get out of the airplane, walk around the right side. I'll walk around the left side. We'll meet at the back, and we'll see what we see. Nothing. He said, do you see? I said, I've seen things. I said, you go the other way. I'll go the other way. Nothing. And we cannot figure this out. So we're walking away from the airplane. We get about 10, 15 feet away, and the plane captain goes, excuse me, Lieutenant, what's the matter with your props? And I turn around, and all 8 blades are bent. And my wings fell off my chest, you know, and I'm standing there going, well, Fritz, we're going to be civilians real soon here. I mean, this is... Well, it was a holiday of sorts. This flight had to get out. It was Fritz's last flight, so everybody else was at a party at the squadron. So the commanding officer was still there, the maintenance chief was still there, the tech rep, plane captain, the two of us. I go get the skipper, and I bring him out to the airplane. He said, you flew that back? That's just as crazy as landing with your gear up. I said, there's nothing wrong with it. And so the tech rep inspected the engine. He said, I can't see anything wrong. And he jumped in the airplane, fired it off, just hummed like a sewing machine. And he gets out of the airplane and said, "What, boy, this is great advertising. Takes it, licking, keeps on ticking." And the skipper says, I don't think so. And he says, it's an accident. And this chief says, sir, I'll just tell you what the chief said. This is the best pilot you got. He said, you can't do this to him. He said, I don't have a choice. And he said, well, in order to call it an accident, it requires 25 hours or more of repair. He said, this is only going to take about an hour, hour and a half. We've got a plane in the hangar that we're using as a parts bin. We'll go in there and take its props off, put it on this airplane, and we'll send these right to the factory. We won't even send them through the Navy system. And he said, huh. He said, well, how do you explain that he hit the runway? And I looked at him and he said, sir, they never scrambled the crew. Nothing. And so for 20-some-odd years, we were sworn to secrecy until a big squadron reunion. And so I crashed an airplane. I'm not an alcoholic. I go to Vietnam. I get an award for a flight that I don't even remember. A significant award. And I arrived late at this place, and they put me up on the stage, and I was in a T-shirt only, not in uniform, no hat, no T-shirt. I have a picture at home of that. Sweat's pouring off of me, sunglasses, and the skipper turns around. He says, here's your medal. You're out of uniform. And I said, yes, sir. He said, where am I supposed to hang this thing? I said, just put it in my hand. Because I'm going to throw up, you know, and I threw up. And I was a legend. I am also sitting in that room over there in Vietnam more than once, at least a dozen times that I can remember, sitting there padlocked on the inside, sitting on the floor, drinking out scotch out of Chivas Regal scotch, $3.25 a quart, drinking it straight out of the refrigerator, sitting there with a Colt 45 loaded off safe, Thompson submachine gun loaded off safe, 2 hand grenades sitting around me trying to figure out which one I was going to use. Because something was wrong, and I knew something was wrong. And then I'd say, do you think you're an alcoholic? Hell no, you're not an alcoholic. Alcoholics aren't combat pilots, alcoholics, don't get in, I'm not in trouble. I don't look like my mother. I don't look like my father. I don't look like my brother who lost a house in a poker game in upstate New York. He's in the Advertising Hall of Fame. He wrote Kentucky Fried Chicken, Finger Licking Good. At Ford Quality is job one. The Dutch Master cigar ads, all that stuff before he ended up on Skid Row in New York. And he came home, he had such a gambling problem, this was about 30 years ago before the casinos were back there, he came home and told his wife, we're moving Monday. They got six kids, each one had their own bedroom on this house, this lake in New York, in Mount Kisco. She said, you get a new job? And he said, no, I lost the house in a poker game. He said, well, tell them you're kidding, she says. He said, no, you don't tell these people. He's playing with the mafia in those days, the bad guys. When you're playing for your house, he'd pink slip the house. And Monday, there was a moving van there. And they moved all the way to San Jose, California to move in with a cousin in a three-bedroom house, and that was the last they saw of him for about 17 years. That's what alcoholism does in my family, and I don't look like that. And thank you. I'm a very successful pilot, looking good. And eventually I ended up getting a training command squadron, and there I got designated as a drug and alcohol prevention educator because I thought it would look good in my record. I've got 2 years left of drinking. I'm the first CO ever to be that designation. I'm running these classes. This third class young petty officer comes in one day and he goes, sir, you've been drinking. I said, yes, I have. And he goes, you're not supposed to. And I said, no, you're not supposed to. I said, you are ordered to this class. I said, this class is about responsible drinking. And I said, I drink responsibly. You don't, you know. And so I sent him to treatment because he got way too close. Oops, excuse me. So I sent his ass to treatment. Thank you. And because of that background training, I ended up getting to run the Navy Alcohol, Drug, and Alcohol Program here in San Diego, the Alcohol Rehabilitation Center, 32nd Street. At that time, was the biggest one literally in the world. It was, I mean, there was a facility in Long Beach. There was one in San Diego. The one up in Long Beach is all in the news. I'm breaking nobody's anonymity. Betty Ford was treated in that system, and Senator Talmadge and Buzz Aldrin. It was all the newspapers and all that. So it was a pretty hot system. And I get it, and I'm not sober yet. But I've got this background. A year and a half into that job, they think I have a heart attack because I'm in such chest pain down my arms. They take me to the hospital, put me on the treadmill, and they said, your heart's like an 18-year-old. They said, are you under stress? Not that I'm aware of. And Jerry Bunn, the guy who became my sponsor, was retiring when I took that job. He called his staff in after he'd met me for about 15 minutes, and he said, oh, my, my, my. We have a full-blown, snot-slinging, gutter-crawling alcoholic on our hands. He's educated beyond his intelligence. He doesn't even know he's an alcoholic, and he's going to be running this place. And he said, and I can't call Washington and tell him it took me 15 minutes to diagnose this. I mean, he was in recovery 14 years at that time. Had been at that place for about 6 years, and he said, it's just going to be the damnedest dry drunk that San Diego's ever seen. And I was crazy. I mean, nobody wants that job, folks. It's not like people are lining up to get the CO of the Alcohol Rehab Center if you're moving up your career pattern here. I got fired. I was so crazy. I was writing Betty Ford and Nancy Reagan telling how screwed up this thing, because Nancy just don't say no, and Betty Ford went through treatment. I'm bypassing the entire chain of command, going straight to them when the Admiral finds out, and he says, get rid of him. Get him out of here. I was just crazy. And at 6 months sober, I'm sitting in Jerry's office, and I am in full dress uniform at that time. I've been out for 20 years now, or 17 years, I guess, and I was crying. And he said, what's the matter? I said, Jerry, you promised me that if I did everything you asked me to do, go to meetings, I go to a meeting a day, I sponsor two poor guys, you know, I make coffee, I sweep floors, we still had real ashtrays in those days, and I didn't even smoke, and I'm washing your ashtrays and coffee cups and all that. And he said, I'd feel better. I said, I've never felt so bad in all my life. And if this is what sobriety is all about, I'm out of here. I'm done with Alcoholics Anonymous because you lied to me big time. I've never felt so much pain in all my life. And I said, this is why I drink. I know how to handle this. And I'm not staying around. And he said, give me a few moments, would you, before you leave? And I said, sure. He said, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I was thinking for a minute. He said, I can't even believe you're thinking. I said, all right. I'm an alcoholic. And he said, do you think your life is, you're powerless over alcohol? I said, sometimes. He said, sometimes about 4 months ago, you said you were. I said, I lied to you. He said, you did? I said, yeah. You wanted to hear it? I lied to you. I'm powerless. In fact, it says in here somewhere on page 141 or so. This is not to say that all alcoholics are honest and upright when not drinking. Of course, this just isn't so. Right there, folks, to the employers. Sober up a horse thief, and you got a sober horse thief. Sober up a liar, and you got a liar. I lied all my life. Grew up in that family. I had to survive in that family I grew up. And I said, why do you think sometimes? I said, sometimes I get drunk, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I make those meetings, those business meetings that I'm supposed to, and sometimes I don't. He said, all right, I'll go with that a moment or two. He said, you think your life's unmanageable? I said, no. He said, no, not even a little. I said, no. He said, why? I said, Jerry, I'm the commanding officer of the largest treatment program in the country. I got a beautiful house, a wife, daughter, height of my career. Thank you very much. No, my life's not unmanageable. And I'm sobbing. And he goes, well, Captain, if your life is working so well, do you think the admiral would find this a little funny that one of his officers is sitting here sobbing? I mean, if your life's working so well, what are you crying for? I thought that was a trick question. I didn't have a real answer to that one. And he said, as you sit here, do you understand any of these words? Verbatim. I still remember that. Separate, different, lonely, afraid, not part of, outside, looking in, don't fit, don't belong. And I leapt out of this chair and I literally popped him in the chest. And I said, holy shit. I said, I understand every one of those words. And he said, welcome to unmanageability. He said, we all get here thinking we're supposed to have lost stuff. You know, I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough and the treatment field long enough when I used to work in it. You know, 3, 4, 5% of us come off the streets. The rest of us come here, quote, unquote, functional. We haven't really lost everything. Our other speaker was talking about the children. I mean, everything was in place, you know. And we come here. And I was not unmanaged, but I understood. Separate, different, lonely, and afraid. My second sponsor, Barney, some of you remember Barney M. And Barney used to say, and he meant this with all sincerity. He said, you know what? I just was waiting for the day when literally a spaceship landed. Three guys would get out and look like Barney. And they'd walk up to me and they'd go, Barney, come on, we're going home now. You know, and we'd all get on the spaceship and go home. Because I just didn't belong here. I didn't fit here. And Jerry said to me that day, he said, Steve, the longest journey we're going to have to make is from your head to your heart. Step one in the big book is not really step one. What does it say? Anybody know? We have to admit to our innermost selves that we are alcoholics. This is the first step of recovery. We have to admit to our innermost selves. I had not done that. Intellectually, I acknowledged I had a severe drinking problem. Intellectually, I understood I was an alcoholic. Intellectually. But it was not okay. And so he asked the $24,000 question. Is it okay for you to be an alcoholic in your heart of hearts? I said, hell no, it's not okay. Everybody in my family is an alcoholic. My mother, my father, 2 grandfathers, 3 uncles, my brother. There's incest, there's violence. I said, I've done none of that. I said, no. I said, I'm a success. No, it's not okay to be an alcoholic. He said, my fear for you, Steve, is because of your arrogance and your ego. If you go back out, you will not ever come back through those doors. It was tough enough to get you here the first time. I don't think you can make it back. We sat there for 4 hours that day. I don't remember what we said. It was almost 5 hours, probably. And it got okay. Absolutely got okay. A couple months later, we went through all the steps, all the traditions. He said, before, my last duty station was in Hawaii, so before we got there, he said, I went you through all that before you go. I got over there. I'm sitting at dinner one night at a little AA convention they had with a couple friends of my sponsor who I just met, and they had Bob and Goldine Lahan. And they had about 30, 35 years sobriety at that time. They were talking about a movie called Hunt for Red October. And they said, have you seen that movie? And I said, yeah, it's a great movie. In fact, some of the planes that I flew, and so forth and so on. He said, well, the new book that he's written called Red Storm Rising, have you read that one? And I had not. And I said, yes, I have. Because instantly I felt less than and not equal to. I mean, I should have read that book. I suppose. I mean, you're supposed to. He'd ask me. And then he starts talking about it. Well, hell, he starts talking about the very thing I did for years in the Navy. So I can carry that on without even seeing the movie. And so we're talking. All of a sudden, his Goldine says to me, she said, Steve, you don't look very well. I said, I don't feel very well. She says, why? I said, because I think I'm going to throw up. He said, why? Is something wrong with the food? And I said, no, I'm going to do something that for the first time in my life, I've never done. I'm going to look at you and tell you I just lied to you about an hour or about a minute ago. She said, what? I said, when you asked, had I read, I hadn't. I'd never even know he wrote the book. We're all boo-hooing in this restaurant, you know, and just crying. And I thought, wow, first time ever I've done that. 5 years later, I'm standing down at in Bonita. There used to be a little Ace Hardware store down there years and years ago in Bonita. My wife said, the biggest secret I had, folks, is that I could not take stuff back to stores. Now, I'm a combat pilot, for the sake of the conversation, carrier pilot. I couldn't take stuff back to literally could not take stuff back to stores. We got a lamp for a gift. She said, why don't you run it back? I said, put it on my workbench. It sat there for almost 6 weeks. I came home one day, and she chip, came home one day, it was gone. I said, where'd the lamp go? She said, I got tired of waiting. I said, I was going to take it back today. I bought a... We go to Sears and buy tools because you can run over it with a tractor. And they'll give you a new one. That's why you buy them there. I got a power saw. Got it out of the box. Circular saw. Plugged it in. Nothing. Tried every circuit in the garage. I knew it was broken. I tried every circuit in the house. It's got to work because I have to take it back. You know what I did with it? I threw it away. Could not take it back because I knew they would say, you're the first man in the history of Sears that we're not giving something back to. I was terrified, absolutely terrified of that confrontation. About 2 years after that, my wife says, I want a security screen door in there, and I've seen it down at that Ace Hardware store. And go down, they had them on sale. And I said, well, that was about 6 months ago. They're off sale now. She said, well, just go and ask them. I don't want to go to ask them. I want to go to this other big store. She said, I want you to go down there. I want that door. I don't want to go down there. She says, there's not an option. Go get that door. So I go down there, and I'm standing there, and I got the door, and it's full price, and the guy is writing it up, and I said, excuse me. And it went just like this. I said, I don't suppose you could give me that screen door for half price. I was on sale at half price about 6 months ago, could you? He goes, okay. And I walked away. And he goes, where are you going? And I said, I forgot something. I wanted to just look around and take the next guy. I went back in this corner. I'm crying like a kid. It was the first time in my life. And then I was 50 years old that I'd ever done anything like that. And I used to beat me up. You know, I go, you're combat pilot. I'd go into a store. I'd walk right back out. I couldn't do that. You think you'd be able to do that, couldn't you? Couldn't you? And I'd beat myself up. Just beat myself up. Something fierce. Maybe 4 or 5 years after that, I bought a bottle of fairly expensive cologne. Took it out of the box, and somehow it was glued. The glass was glued somehow to the box, and it literally pulled a sliver out of the bottle. And it just all went away. And I was kind of cussed. My wife said, what happened? She said, well, just take it back to the drugstore. I said, it's not that big of a deal. I said, I'm not going to dry it. She said, it's only 2 minutes to the drugstore. I said, it's not that expensive. She said, it was like $20 or something. She said, take it back. And then she goes, oh, never mind, because I told her. I said, never mind, do what you want to do. But she washed it and put it on my dresser with the receipt. So that afternoon, I go back up to Long's Bias. I pull in. I stop. About have a heart attack. I backed the car out, went back to our house, sat in the driveway, backed to Long's, got in the drive, drove around Long's, parked the car, walked in with this guy. I said, this piece of glass came out. He said, well, just go get another one. You know, today I've taken back pre-cut lumber that I measured wrong. And they took it back. You know, but I couldn't do that for years and years. At 10 years sober, my sponsor moved back to the East Coast. I had a new sponsor named Ralph. Some of you know Ralph. I got two sponsees approached me one day that I just dearly love. I sponsored them both for about 18 years, 19 years now. And they said, we need to go to coffee. I said, okay. So we're sitting at coffee, and I'm thinking, what can I do for you boys? And they say, we would like to talk. I said, go ahead. And they said, we're going to talk about you. And we think you need a new sponsor. I said, you think I need a new sponsor? Is that what you're saying? And they said, yes. And I said, I'm not proud of it. The last time I looked, I'm your sponsor. I don't take this shit from you guys. John Gray turns to Roger Shadow and goes, I won. I knew he'd say that. And I said, why do you think I need one? He said, because your shit's flowing downhill on us. And now we're not going anywhere, but it's getting a little dirty down here. So you need a new sponsor. And they were right. And so I got Ralph. And I went up to Ralph and I said, I need a new sponsor, and I did. And some stuff had started to surface. And some of the stuff had started, two items had really come to the surface at about 11 years sober. And one guy had shared in a meeting, which brought it up, and that was some stuff regarding some stuff that went on in Vietnam, and I won't go into details. It was just really bad stuff. And I had not dealt with that. And the other stuff that was coming up was incest. And I had not dealt with that. I had brushed it, but I had not dealt with it. So he started me on some writing. And it was incest towards me by both parents. And he opened me up like a can of worms. And about that time, I get asked to speak at a conference in St. Louis. So I stop in Kansas City to see my sister on the way by, and while I'm there, she tells me about the incest towards her. Well, I hit this conference, and I tell you folks, I'm an absolute basket case. And I get to the airport, and the guy picked me up. I said, I need to go talk to the conference chairman, please. And we go talk, and I said, Bob was his name. And I said, Bob, get a new speaker. I cannot do this. I am just an emotional wreck. Spiritual wreck. I'm angry at God. I'm angry at people. I'm angry at parents. I'm angry at me. And I said, I don't want to talk. And he goes, well, okay, I'll get a backup. And I said, in fact, if I could get this ticket turned around, I'd be out here tonight. But he said, well, why don't you stay? You need to stay. I think you need to stay. Stay surrounded by AA and God and recovery. And he said, the night that I was supposed to speak, he said, just at least do us the honor of sitting up here. I said, okay. So 5 minutes before the main speaker is to speak, he leans over and he says, my sponsor and my grand sponsor and I voted. You're speaking. And I said, the hell I am. And they said, the hell you're not. And you're either going to trust God or you're not going to trust God. And if something happens, I forget this, he'll stand up and do what he's got to do. I don't remember much of anything that I talked about. The next morning, this guy came up to me. And we were at breakfast, and a bunch of people sitting around. He said, I'd like to thank you for last night. I said, you're welcome. And he said, would you stand up, please? And I said, okay. He said, can I hug you? I said, sure. And then he leans in, and he whispers. He says, my name is Jim. I'm 75 years old. I'm 35 years sober. You're the first man that I've told I was incested by my father. Thank you for your share last night. He said, now I'll go call my sponsor. We will not regret the past. We will not wish to shut the door. Our character defects will become our greatest assets. And those things which have scared us the most. You have something that you don't want to talk about. But you're the only person that can share that with somebody. I promise you, someday you'll be sitting across, and it's now happened, I can't even think of the number of times. I'll be sitting talking to some guy, we'll be sitting there talking, and all of a sudden I look at him and said, if we're not by ourselves, can we just step outside a minute? Can I ask you a question? Get real forward here. Are we talking about incest? He said, how'd you know? I said, I know. You want to talk? Let's talk. You know, so those things that we don't want to talk about, we do. And so, you know, I've marched through recovery and that, you know, and he's almost done. I'll end with this. When I was 5 years sober, my daughter went to her mom and said, I was out of the Navy by then, and she said, remember when Dad was flying back and forth between Hawaii? And she said, yeah. So I just can't live with it. I have to tell you that I was praying that the airplane he was flying would crash. I had emotionally and spiritually abused her so badly. At 7 years, she came to me and said, Dad, my best friend is pregnant. Okay. She can't talk to her mom and dad. I said, you can talk to my dad because you can trust him. He won't hurt you. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. She wants me dead, you know, and now she is telling me that trust me with her best friend. Alcoholics Anonymous does work, folks. It absolutely works. I heard a story that I still love to tell because it really describes. I grew up in this family of just negativity and nothingness and no love, nothing. There's a story about a little boy comes home and says, Dad, I need to borrow $9, please. Or, I need $9. And his father says, you need $9? You're only 10 years old. What do you need $9 for? He says, I can't tell. I just need $9. He said, son, I hold two jobs. Sometimes I work three jobs. I work night shifts so I can barely get together $30 an hour because he had this huge family, so I just need to do this. You ungrateful little kid. Sends him to his room. A week later, boy's back. Dad, I need $9. He said, did you hear me last week? You know how hard I work for my money? $30. He says, and he just smacks him and sends him to his room. Next week, the persistent little boy is back. He says, Dad, I need $9. And this time, the father wails on him and just sends him to his room. The kid is in there just sobbing. His dad goes in and he says, son, I am so, so sorry. Obviously, you need the money. Obviously, you do. Here's the $9. The kid reaches under her pillow, pulls out all this money, and he said, what the heck? How much money you got there? And he said, Dad, I got $21. I just needed $9 more so I could have 30 so I could buy an hour of your time. See, that's all I wanted from my dad and my mom. I just wanted an hour of their time, and they couldn't give it to me. Because one was gone when I was 5, and the other was gone from the time they were drunk. I never had that. My brother was long gone. You know, and you can come here to any meeting, and for free, you get an hour, or 2 hours, or 4 hours, or 5 hours. For the newcomer, stay. Don't keep new, stay. For the old timers, keep coming back. You know, although you have a life out there, the foundation is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is why we're here. Come on back. Do the steps. Get a sponsor. Go to meetings. You know, and let sobriety work in your life. Thanks.